You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the armistice that ended the Korean War. But for one village in South Korea's West Seacoast, the armistice marked the beginning, not the end, of a U.S. bombing campaign. From Mayeni, South Korea, Aaron Glantz has this second in our five-part series on Korea, 50 years after the war.
Tuesday at 6 p.m. in Mayeni, and a U.S. Air Force Apache helicopter flies along the boardwalk. It's almost never quiet here. The sky is full of F-15, F-16, and A-10 fighter jets. The Air Force has brought them from all over the Pacific to this South Korean village, where American soldiers stationed in Okinawa, Japan, Thailand, and Guam, this is the place to practice. Fighter jets take to the skies up to 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, to bomb a small island less than a mile away from Mayeni. This has been the arrangement since August 1951, when U.S. troops retook the area from North Korea as part of the Korean War. The American Army set up the practice bombing range unilaterally without consulting with the South Korean government. In order to do that, America needed land. Choi Soon-sun is the oldest resident of Mayeni. He is 87 years old.
I had a farm. I planted lettuce, and one day the U.S. Army was driving on my farm, and I got upset. And I hit the soldier in the head with a rake, and the soldier pointed a gun at me. Anyway, I don't have a farm anymore. It was 6,000 square meters, but the government took it from me.
Choi wasn't the only farmer who lost his land to the bombing range. 67-year-old Che Chu-pin remembers when the U.S. Army took his family farm in 1951. A year later, an American practice bomb landed on his sister.
In 1952,
when my younger sister was 10 years old, she was looking for oysters on the beach. There was an island called Kobe Island then, but it's all gone now because it's been bombed so much by the Americans. She was working when an American airplane dropped a bomb right next to her. It ripped through her leg and her thigh was destroyed. Since then, she has been lame. One leg is longer than the other.
Che Chu-pin also blames the American Army for his son's disability. He says his son was playing with a slingshot around toxic residue from the bombing range when some of the residue got in his eyes. His son has been blind ever since. Still, Che Chu-pin doesn't want the Americans to leave Mayeni. That's because he remembers the North Korean occupation of his village, which he says was even worse.
The North Korean army was preparing to kill all the leaders of the village when the American soldiers liberated us. But before that, they took everything. They took chickens, cows, and things. They didn't care about the residents. They just took everything. And they only occupied us for 3 months.
But most people in Mayeni don't agree with Che. Yi Son Nim is 62 years old. Like Che Chu-pin's sister, she makes her living hunting for oysters. Life is hard in Mayeni, so all her children and grandchildren have moved away.
Every day I find a bomb fragment while I'm looking for a clam. Most days I find four or five. It's so hard to live here. I hope the Americans leave.
The Bush administration has made no moves towards closing the bombing range at Mayeni, but the villagers here have made significant gains in recent years. 3 years ago, the Clinton administration agreed to stop bombing the areas closest to the village. Residents of Mayeni are also suing the South Korean government for millions of dollars in pain and suffering, with the final ruling due next week. They can't sue the American military, though. Under the terms of a deal the U.S. government negotiated with the South Korean military dictatorship in 1968, the U.S. military is immune from prosecution in South Korea. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Mehani, South Korea.
Closer to home, voices of dissent are being quietly squashed in the U.S. as a result of the enactment of the so-called Patriot Act. Cornel West, professor of theology at Princeton University, offers sage advice and encouragement to learn from the lessons of the African-American struggle for justice. In this speech in Santa Fe, New Mexico last month, West tied the black struggle for civil rights to the struggle of peace activists for peace and justice today.
For me, one of the great moments of American culture actually occurred in August of 1955. Very few people want to talk about it. 1955, of course, Emmett Till was murdered by fellow citizens, victim of U.S. terrorism. His body thrown in the Yazoo River under the Tallahatchie Bridge. But his body was brought back to Chicago. And the first major civil rights demonstration took place. 125,000 fellow citizens walked by to take a look. And Emmett Till, his mother, left the coffin open so they could see. It's a Pilgrim Baptist Church led by the Reverend Julius Caesar Austin, and he introduced Mom's Teal Mabley, and she walked to the lectern. She looked over at her baby, whose head was five times the size of his normal head, and she looked in the eyes of America as well as the folk on at South Side Chicago, and she said, "What? I don't have a minute to hate. I'm going to pursue justice for the rest of my life." That's a level of spiritual maturity and moral maturity that does not give up on the Socratic attempt to interrogate the mendacity and hypocrisy of American life. But it's rooted in something deep. It's rooted in an attempt to keep track of the humanity of the very people who have dehumanized you. Use that as a standard of responding to terrorism in light of the last 2.5 years. My God, how fascinating.
Here's Moms Mabley speaking on her behalf and speaking for the best of the tradition. Martin King's in the background. Fannie Lou Hamer's voice is there. A. Philip Randolph's voice is there. And many nameless and anonymous black leaders who knew they had to deal with a situation in which they were unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated for who they were. That's what it meant to be a nigger. Unsafe, unprotected, subject to unjustified violence, and hated. Now, after September 11, all Americans feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated. You say, now that the whole nation's been niggerized, let's see what the response is gonna be. Interesting. I come from a tradition that says in the face of terrorism, it's justice, not sweet revenge, not short-term retaliation. It's justice. Hunt them down if they've committed a crime, yes. Demonize, no. And even within the black tradition, if there are black folk who demonize, they are criticized based on that tradition in light of their not aspiring to the standards of Emmett Till's mother. And if that's the case, that's certainly the case for George Bush and other leaders. Crucial, indispensable, bringing together the best of the legacy of Athens, the best of the legacy of Jerusalem, but in the New World context in which legacies of slavery, Jim Crow, police brutality, lynching, discrimination, redlining and bank loans, on and on and on. Always connecting one's vision about one's own freedom to plight and predicament of others, sisters of all colors, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, physically challenged brothers, indigenous brothers and sisters. So that they all constitute overlapping and intertwining traditions of struggle. But knowing that the courage to think critically and the courage to love, and I think we need to talk publicly about the courage to love. That's what I love about
the best of the black freedom movement. You see, it's very rare that you find progressives. These are my dear white brothers and sisters speaking publicly about love. Abraham Joshua Heschel did. Dorothy Day did. Early Michael Harrington did. The later Michael Harrington, who I worked with very closely, he had shifted from a certain Catholicism to a certain socialism, but was consistent across the board. And he was my comrade in both instances. He just changed his mind on some things. But James Baldwin talked about love explicitly as the most difficult, dangerous, but also the most significant force in the world. Why? Because if you come from a people who have been so hated, love can become subversive and transformative, beginning by loving yourself. Marcus Garvey talked about love explicitly. Yes, Elijah Muhammad didn't talk about loving white brothers and sisters, but that wasn't his only point. There's other people in the world other than white brothers and sisters. Now, he was immature to have to base the love of black people on devaluing white people, but he talked about black people loving themselves. Mr. Louis Farrakhan the same way. Much progress and evolution necessary in terms of his building on Elijah in an early stage, yes, but he's talking about loving themselves. Why is that important? Because it's a form of agency. It gives people a sense of confidence. And part of the problem of America is what? People don't feel like they have any agency. They don't feel that they're confident in making a difference at all. And especially in the States, where, my God, what was it in the election, the last election? 80% of white America thought the election was fair, and 80% of black America thought it was unfair. And somebody's right and wrong about this thing. I'm not a relativist at all. There's a fact about the matter. 32% of black people for the war. Nearly 75% is white America for the war. There's a difference here. Agency makes a difference for people who are cutting against the grain in their perceptions. Love becomes a form of agency. And not only that, but it helps break down the barriers, the walls of demarcation. And so even when the black rage and the black fury, the righteous indignation of having to look white supremacy in the face in all of its dimensions and still persists, the language of love still allows white brothers and sisters to recognize that it's not all of them or it's not genetic. The white brothers and sisters can make choices. Because it's all about choices, decisions, commitments. No one is locked into a pigeonhole or some category. So the love becomes crucial. And not only that, but of course I believe that it's impossible to talk seriously about fundamentally transforming America or any other country, but especially America. It's impossible to do that without talking about forms of spirituality, and especially music. Spirituality is all about how do you deal with your constraints and limitations. And when you run up against that anange, those constraints and limitations, you're going to need something to fall back on, like a community that is sustained by levels of spirituality which have to do with contesting, which have to do with sharing, which have to do with sustaining persons so that they don't become short-term freedom fighters. We need freedom fighters like Amy Goodman who are in it for the long haul, and that's hard to do. And we come now to our present moment, and what do we see? A bleak moment. Let's be honest. One of the bleakest moments in the history of the civilization. America is now, it's not only an empire, but in scope, in depth, in power, it exceeds the British and the Roman empires. Nothing like it in the history of humankind. No countervailing force at all. The repressive and regimenting Soviet Empire went under 12 years ago. It was a countervailing force. It supported Mandela when he was a terrorists for 27 years. We like to remind Americans of that.
But there's no countervailing force at all. And like most empires, it's arrogant, hubris, feels as if it can shape the world in its own image, dictate its terms in terms of what it wants to do.
And as my dear brother Noam Chomsky reminds us, not only puts forward a new doctrine of preemptive strike, because that's a doctrine that says that if it looks as if someone's about to attack you, you attack them before they're able to. That's not what the new doctrine is. This doctrine says if a nation has a set of elites who are contemplating possibly challenging the U.S. power, they are subject to attack. That's preventive war. That's a new norm in international relations. It's the law of the jungle. And it sends signs and signals. Troops of 100 nations, bases in 70 nations, a major carrier in every ocean, internally. 1% of the population owning 48% of net wealth, financial wealth. 5% on 70% of the wealth. And that's before the tax cut. And the result is what? As you can imagine, the most vulnerable. Beginning with who? The children. It's already 22% of all of America's children live in poverty. The richest nation in the history of the world. It's a disgrace. Disgrace. The children. It's 7% in Canada. It's 6% in Japan. It's 22% in America. 42% of red children, 39% of brown children, 37% of black children. They are 100% of the future. Poverty educates. It shapes the way they look at the world. Gives them a sense of who they are, the untrustworthiness of existence. And here, the greatest empire in the history of the world has this plutocratic, oligarchic, to some degree still pigmentocratic, hierarchy in its economy. And then the most vulnerable, the children. And who are connected to those children? Poor women. Workers of both genders. Handicapped. Disproportionately black, brown, and red, yes, but numerically mainly. White brothers and sisters, where's the discourse? Where's the outrage? Where's the indignation? Or is it that the sleepwalking taking place has become so normative that we feel as if we can't make a difference? What is going on? Thank God again for our artists. The Lord, there's some dynamics going on the global scale. And we know what? No empire lasts forever. All empires come and go, they ebb and flow.
Chickens do come home to roost. You're going to reap what you sow. Sooner or later, reality's going to come back on you. You can only live in a state of denial for so long. You can only hide and conceal your structures and institutions in place that don't at the present highlight the dilapidated school systems in chocolate cities, unavailable health care for 44 million fellow citizens. Difficulty regaining access to child care, especially given the welfare reform signed by a spineless Democrat named Bill Clinton. Playing political football with the lives of poor people to win the next election, trying to triangulate with the Republican Party. Ought to be ashamed of himself. Now, he's a friend of mine. I've told him this, so I'm not speaking behind his back. But just plain speech, frank speech. That's all. Just trying to tell the truth. With love.
Dr. Cornell West, professor of theology at Princeton University, speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at an event sponsored by the Lennon Foundation. Special thanks to Thunder Road Productions for that recording. According to Dr. West, in the fight for peace and justice, there is a need to keep track of the humanity of our opponents to maintain the moral high ground. In her book, Ideas for Action, Relevant Theory for Radical Change, author Cynthia Kaufman takes a step back from the day-to-day issues to gain an historical perspective that allows forward movement with a comprehensive and realistic view of the world. When we spoke with her earlier this week, Kaufman raised the issue of misconceptions and misinformation that have stagnated efforts for positive social change. Today, we continue our conversation by asking Kaufman what she feels the peace movement accomplished in the run-up to the war on Iraq.
It accomplished a tremendous amount, and it's so easy to forget that because, you know, one of the things it accomplished was the U.S. government was planning to just go in and just bomb the hell out of that country. And although they bombed it severely and achieved some of their objectives, if it wasn't for the attention that was given to the situation because of the peace movement, because it was because of the peace movement that you had all that wrangling in the United Nations that went on for so long, and so many of the other countries of the world became active in their opposition to it. And I think that had a serious impact in cutting back the severity of the bombing, which meant that probably tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians were saved by the peace movement. And, of course, numbers like that, you know, you can't, we never get credit for that sort of thing. The other thing I think is really crucial is that it's hard to remember, but before all of that happened, before the people were so mobilized to stop that war, I felt like the kind of level of McCarthyism going on in this country was just getting to an unbearable point where it felt like to disagree with anything the government did was just impossible. And it was getting really, really frightening. And I still think we're in a frightening time. The peace movement made it such that there was then an alternative voice in this country. And it became possible that people knew that there were a lot of people who disagreed with the war, and we weren't marginalized as much as usual because the movement was so big. I think it changed the consciousness in this country tremendously so that McCarthyism has backed off.
A protest of the World Bank or the IMF, you will see lots of young, and I'll have to say, tend to be liberal white students that are just passionately protesting the policies of the World Bank and the IMF.
Right.
And these are the issues that they're turning out to address.
That's right. And I think it's one of the interesting things, that the kind of racial aspect about those protests, mm-hmm. is that if you think about it on a worldwide scale, most of the people in the world who are protesting the policies of the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization are people of color, because most people are in the poor countries of the world. And so the leadership of that movement actually is a people of color movement. But in the United States, it's mostly a white movement. One of the really big things that we have to address in social justice work in the United States is the issue of race. And woven throughout my book is analysis of race, the way race and racism have impacted social justice work in the U.S.
Well, you do talk about white racial unity and the lack of class consciousness.
Uh-huh.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Oh, what I mean by that is that one of the things that happens in the United States is that white folks have been given a sense of specialness, you know, because of the whole history of white supremacy or as a result of that. And as a consequence, even poor white folks who would really benefit, you know, just in basic economic terms, if they were to unite with people of color, often instead see themselves as part of the ruling class. And so there's a way that by white people seeing themselves as unified and together and against people of color, they end up not serving their own interests very well.
So how do you fix that?
Well, one of the ways you fix that is by doing a lot of work among white folks to talk about that. There's a whole movement of kind of white studies and consciousness around whiteness that I think has been really important. You know, in the past, so much of the work around race that's been done in this country has been done either among people of color or among whites who thought they were helping people of color. And I think now there's a new movement that's developing where white folks are starting to think, well, what does race mean to me? You know, I'm white, and that means something. I'm in the racial structure. Race doesn't just impact people of color. The concept of race and the way race works impacts all of us. So there's a lot of work being done now organizing sort of consciousness raising among white folks. And that's one of the things that's happening within the anti-globalization movement, is that there is an anti-racist movement within that movement of people saying, look, we're framing the issues in ways that make it more attractive to white folks and less attractive to people of color, and we need to rethink that. We need to change that. So I think that just kind of basic consciousness-raising work among whites. There's a wonderful organization in the Bay Area called Challenging White Supremacy that does a lot of workshops, and they actually go to other cities and do workshops. And that's one thing I would really recommend,
mm-hmm.
so that when white folks go through those workshops, they end up being a little bit less self-righteous. You know, there's a way that racism nowadays, I think, works really strongly culturally among white folks, so that we sort of center our experience. You know, my way of doing things is the right way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens so much among social justice people, where you start to feel like, you know, I'm a radical, and so I have it all figured out, and anybody who disagrees with me is wrong. And unfortunately, we often don't see the ways that our cultural ways of being radical are white ways.
For example.
Oh, I think, you know, one of them is about just wanting to say no to everything. And there's a certain kind of ultra-radicalism that I think is easy for privileged white folks. You know, if you're a young white person and you go up against the state and you get arrested and you can do all kinds of crazy things and then give it up a couple years later and have a mainstream life and you're not taking very big risks, Whereas if you're African-American or Latino young person and you do those kinds of things, you could get yourself thrown in jail for the rest of your life. Or, you know, or even if you're thrown in jail for a little bit of time and you get a bad record, that can really screw up your future. If you're white and you just reject society, you know, because you can just sort of say, well, I'm against the mainstream society because it's this dominant white thing and I hate it. If you're a young person of color, you're much more likely to feel connected to your community and to get some nurture and salvation from that community. And so you're not going to be quite as anti as if you're a white person. So then there's a kind of a just a sort of general I'm against everything kind of an attitude that's possible for a young white person, I think isn't as viable for a young person of color.
And so is there some specific message within your book that speaks to how the peace movement might benefit from your work?
I'm not sure how specific I can be about that. One of the things that my book does is it gives some background and some depth. One of the things I find a little bit frustrating about the peace movement, like any social justice movement, is that we're in a time where I think the social justice people are fairly anti-intellectual and not really taking the time and putting in the energy to reflect on what we're doing. And so we're coasting a lot on kind of ideas and practices from the past. So, for example, you know, we feel like if we're against something, we should just go out and do a protest. And we often don't ask ourselves, well, why are we protesting? Who are we trying to affect? How do we want the media to conceive of this? What kinds of tactics are appropriate? And we often don't even ask those kinds of questions. So what my book has to offer that movement is a space for reflection and some, you know, some practical reflection on those ideas and a real encouragement to reflect and take ideas more seriously. I think in this society we're so individualistic that we don't understand that there are social structures around us, that we're who we are and how we act and how we get resources are all the results of social structures, which are, you know, deeply embedded and really hard to change.
Cynthia Kaufman, the author of Ideas for Action, Relevant Theory for Radical Change. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA, Jabari Zakia, Yolanda Turner, and Sitaria Joyner. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.